You are listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
Well, hello everyone and good afternoon. Welcome to the Carnegie Endowment. I'm Ashley Tellis. I'm a senior associate here at the Endowment working in areas of Asian security and Asian politics. And we have a very special guest with us this afternoon to speak on a subject that obviously is going to be increasingly important as we think about Asia and Asian security in the years ahead. The Sino-Indian relationship, as we all recognize, is one of the two axial relationships in Asia. The way China's relationships with India evolve and the way China's relationships with Japan evolve will be one of the two critical pillars of Asian security. Of course, not forgetting the way China's relationship with the United States evolves, which is always the perennial pillar. But today, Rory Metcalf is going to focus his attention on that one element, which is the Sino-Indian relationship. Uniquely, it is a very complex relationship that cannot be captured by simple terms like competition or cooperation. And both actors are not unconstrained actors. Both China and India live in a world that has essentially been defined, at least traditionally, by American power and American institutions. And so their behaviors exhibit certain patterns that are quite unlike those seen in the U.S.-Soviet relationship at the height of the Cold War, which makes the relationship very interesting. And the question that Rory is going to speak about, which is how does one recognize rivalry or competition, even more interesting. Because I suspect if this rivalry comes about, it'll be a rivalry embedded in a very complex set of economic interactions and disguised by all manner of other agreements on issues of global order. Rory is perfect to address this task. He spent a good bit of his professional career in the Office of Net Assessments in the Australian government, and therefore saw decision-making from the inside. He also was a diplomat, and in fact, that's when I think I first met Rory, when he was in Delhi, and has a very great understanding of the complexities of Indian domestic politics insofar as they affect India's foreign policy choices. So both as a intelligence analyst and as a diplomat, Rory has been witness to some of the dramatic transformations that have taken place in India over the last decade. And now as a scholar at the Lowy Institute, he has increasingly focused on looking at Asia writ large. Rory, by the way, has written an excellent chapter in a book that I've edited, which will be released later this week, on how Australia perceives the emerging relationship between China and India. And today he's not going to focus on an Australian perspective necessarily, though obviously his remarks would be tinged by that, but to kind of address the larger question of what can we anticipate in the Sino-Indian relationship and how do we make sense of it. So without further ado, I will yield the microphone to Rory Metcalf, and I hope you will join me in giving him a rousing welcome since he's come from down under. Thank you, Rory.
Thank you very much, Ashley, and we'll see whether or not that's deserved presently. One small favour I might ask. I just realised I've neglected to bring a timepiece with me, so I'll rely on you to keep me honest. Sure. Thank you. Sure. I'll speak for about 25 minutes. Yeah. Is that good? Yeah, that's great. So what I want to talk about today, India and China, how to recognise rivalry. As you might guess from the title, I'm not starting with the assumption that rivalry exists. It's become a very popular notion in describing this emerging relationship, and I will certainly argue there are some very strong competitive impulses there, but I think we need to, both for the sake of good assessment, good analysis, and also for the sake of crafting the right policy responses to what we're seeing, I think we have to be very precise in understanding what the relationship is. So I'm going to set some quite high standards today for how we define rivalry. Let's see if this works. Great. So, as I've said, the term rivalry is certainly in vogue. I think The Economist last year had a very dramatic cover, almost as lurid as this image here, of an arm wrestle between India and China, the contest of the century. And it's true that these emerging great powers, if you like, Asia's rising giants, it's true that they have fought before in 1962 and various incidents, skirmishes on the border since then. And I think we can't discount the possibility that they could use force against each other again. But I do think we have to really critically analyse this argument that this will be the defining contest or one of the defining contests of the 21st century. So I'll go through the, I guess, a quick excursion through the past. I'll focus on trying to define the relationship as it is now across several dimensions, diplomacy, economics, a strategic dimension, and I guess what we might call soft power. Then I'll try to identify whether it's approaching a state of rivalry across these dimensions. Finally, I want to explore a couple of issues or a couple of complications, such as China's relationship with Pakistan, such as the emerging domain of maritime security in the Indian Ocean and beyond, a couple of factors that I think are going to really test this relationship in the years ahead. Finally, I will conclude with a couple of words about Australia. This is not an Australia-specific analysis, but I can't help bringing a bit of national background to bear, and I think Australia's own dilemma in relation to these two rising powers is a fascinating study for us all. Firstly, what is rivalry? Now, of course, you can't always assume that the tiger that is in the upright position is going to be the one that's in the strongest position by the end of the day. But, you know, there's this saying that gets used a lot in describing the India-China relationship, you know, can two tigers share a mountain? I think it's been used in a recent book by a good Canadian friend and colleague on this issue. I would argue that we can't adopt very simple definitions of rivalry here. We shouldn't assume that all competition is rivalry. A few conditions I think that need to be met. Firstly, it's an extreme form of interstate competition for relative influence. It covers more than one dimension. I don't think that a purely economic competition or even a purely military competition is necessarily full-blown rivalry. So I identify at least four dimensions that we need to satisfy: economic, military, diplomatic, and soft power. I don't think rivalry can be one-sided. I know that I think it was Susan Shirk wrote a very good piece some years ago describing India-China relations as essentially a one-sided rivalry, because, of course, India's threat perceptions about China are far more acute, we believe, at least on the public record anyway, than China's are about India at this stage. And finally, I think rivalry must engage vital national interests of both powers. In other words, they must be willing ultimately to make threats of the use of force and be willing to follow through with those before it can be a full-blown geopolitical rivalry, which is what I'm talking about here today. And I guess we're already asking a few questions of ourselves. To what extent does this apply to China and India? A quick excursion into history. I spoke at a conference in Melbourne last week where a very eminent Indian of a very strong Nehruvian persuasion argued that 1962 was not India's China war, nor was it China's India war. It was a war that that should never have happened. And I guess that was great rhetoric. It was a fine, tragic point to make. But it begs the question, whose war was it? I mean, it clearly was a war that India and China brought about themselves. It wasn't due to any sort of third-party foreign hand or third power. In other words, these powers are capable of coming to blows all of their own making. And this, in turn, goes back to the question of their relations after Indian independence and after the establishment of the People's Republic of China. Was it always doomed to a competitive state? There were very early hopes, as we know, really throughout the 1950s, of essentially a sense of non-aligned solidarity between these two powers. Nehru was especially attached to this idea, Hindi Chini, bye-bye, the brotherhood of the two powers. And I think as the conflict in 1962 showed, and indeed the tensions building up to that conflict, these were probably pinned on rather unrealistic expectations. I won't belabor you with the history of how 1962 started. There are multiple accounts, as we know, but there was certainly some gross miscalculation on the Indian side, if nothing else. The legacy of that conflict, which of course involved China dealing quite a swift and bitter blow to India, and then perhaps almost deepening the humiliation by withdrawing its forces after the blow had been struck, the legacy of that, I think, has left a very deep mistrust in India towards China. And what's particularly notable is that in the years that followed, as, for example, the argument for an Indian nuclear weapon began to gather pace, because, of course, China followed its victory in 1962 pretty quickly on 1964 with testing its first nuclear device. As China began to cultivate and deepen its relations with Pakistan throughout the 1960s and 1970s, I do think we saw a pretty frosty period enter China-India relations, or a really very frosty period. And it could be argued that this was the low point, prolonged low point of the relationship. It could only get better after that. There was no economic relationship essentially to speak of, and the as for the soft power dimension, again, very, very limited interaction. It was really only, I guess, communist movements in India, which were and are, of course, very substantial, that maintained a positive view of China during that period. There certainly wasn't a business lobby asking for a closer relationship with Beijing. Now, I would argue that period satisfied all or many of the conditions of rivalry. Gradual improvement in the relations in the 80s and into the 90s, and I would say that really what we saw, interestingly enough, following the Indian nuclear test, following the pretty quick international re-engagement with India after 1998, I think we saw a diplomatic high point reached in the China-India relationship, probably the first 5 years or so of this century. That's because not only were we seeing engagement at a military and security level, we were seeing confidence-building measures of a sort coming into place on the border, really from the 90s onwards. We were seeing high-level diplomatic visits, but we were also seeing serious economic engagement, really for the first time in the existence of these two nations as modern independent states. It's extraordinary to think that the first direct air route between Beijing and New Delhi, as far as I'm aware, was established around 2002. It took that long since the 50s to establish this air route, and even then it was generally pretty obscure airlines flying at pretty ungodly hours. It still wasn't the best way to get between the two capitals. If you're a businessman, you were still more likely to go via Hong Kong. I'll quickly go through a few of the dimensions of the relationship as it is now, or as it's evolved in recent years. There is no question that there is a strengthening economic relationship, and the basic fact for us all to be aware of is that China is now India's largest trading partner, has overtaken the US pretty comprehensively in that regard. And that's a pretty extraordinary development, and obviously a good thing if we're looking at ways to minimise or mitigate security competition and rivalry. And you can see here a sense here of the dramatic growth in the economies, which is obviously going to speak to the potential for trade to increase. But you can also get a sense that that this has really got a long way to go. At the moment, I think we're seeing trade between the two powers of about $60 billion a year, and there are projections for this to double within a few years, coming up from a very, very long way down. And of course, as a power, although it's true that we don't look at India as, you know, precisely a peer of China anytime soon in any numerical sense, nonetheless, or in any, you know, simple calculus of economic or military weight, nonetheless, if pretty standard linear projections hold for the next few decades, we will see India as the third largest power by an order of magnitude ahead of others. So it is fair to speak of it of India and China, if not as precisely as peers, then as both great powers, not just by dint of their population size. Again, the military dimension, and these are extremely crude projections that we've done, essentially, to use a bit of Australian vernacular, a sort of a bastardised combination of Goldman Sachs and IISS. But it does give you a sense of the potential for these two countries to grow in military spending, and again, India becoming the third largest military power, again by an order of magnitude, if we assume that Japan is going to essentially flatline as these statistics statistics suggest. Now, I've spoken about the balance of trade. This was actually the slide I was looking for when I mentioned that. But it's really becoming a very serious trade relationship for India, not so much for China, and yet at the same time, the balance of trade is in China's favour. In a few moments, we'll unpack some of the components of this trade, and we'll see why it's not as healthy a trading relationship as it can or should be, and why it's not actually having a big impact at the moment on minimising negative perceptions in India of China's rise. It's true that in recent years we've seen cooperation, and I guess that those inverted commas aren't entirely ironic. We've seen some genuine attempts at diplomatic cooperation between the two powers. For Western countries, of course, this hasn't always been a helpful or positive sign, as the experience at Copenhagen in 2009 would suggest. There's been certainly functional cooperation between India and China on some big global issues like climate change. It's tended, however, to be not only issue-specific but event-specific. It's not a rolling campaign of cooperation. It tends to be coordination on an occasion, but without these two powers necessarily then warning one another of their long-term strategies in that area. We've seen dialogues, bilateral, trilateral and so forth, involving the two powers. We often hear about a foreign minister's dialogue between Russia, India and China as if this is an indication of an emerging bloc, which I certainly think it isn't. And we've also seen some interesting cooperation on the energy front. In 2005, 2006, there was a short-lived, I think, moment where there was a genuine Indian attempt, at least by the then petroleum minister, to cooperate with China in energy. There were several deals where India and China essentially agreed not to outbid one another on. But even these deals in essentially the hundreds of millions of dollars were dwarfed by the billion or multi-billion dollar deals that China was still outbidding India on at the same time. On the military front, as I've said, there has been some improvement in cooperation, or at least in trust. The confidence-building process on the border since the 1990s is notable because it doesn't follow the same logic that China applies to maritime confidence-building in East Asian waters that we're seeing at the moment. In other words, the mantra that trust must come before functional military confidence-building measures wasn't applied by China to the India-China border, which is good news at one level because it suggests that the Chinese establishment is quite capable of adopting that much more pragmatic attitude when it wants to. But it also raises curious questions as to why China hasn't been willing to take such a pragmatic approach on the maritime front. There have been evolving forums of dialogue between India and China, even limited combined exercises of the two countries, especially with a counter-terrorism focus. But I would argue these have not made a fundamental difference in changing the levels of trust or mistrust between the two countries. So let's move on to assessing these competitive dynamics and whether they meet the conditions of rivalry. Firstly, let's talk broadly about diplomacy with a strategic dimension. It's often argued that the great common needs of these two emerging powers, the fundamental need to satisfy the human needs of their massive populations, will drive these two countries towards cooperation or at least coexistence. And incidentally, the term throughout this that I would apply rather than rivalry at this stage is competitive coexistence between the two powers. But I would also argue that many of these commonalities also have the potential to be factors for tension between the two powers for a number of reasons. One is if there isn't objectively a zero-sum dynamic on these issues. I mean, for example, if there is potential for India and China to cooperate on water security, on energy security, on procuring resources in third countries. Nonetheless, at the moment, I think the two capitals are looking with a zero-sum mentality at a lot of these issues. And this is reinforced by nationalism in both countries. I think it's reinforced by the media in both countries, and I include the Chinese media there. I include the so-called netizens there as well, the social media. And I think it's also reinforced by institutional imperatives on both sides, and not only defence ministry or defence imperatives. The border dispute is unresolved, and what's intriguing is that there were signs of a resolution, I'd say 7 or 8 years ago. There were signs that the contours of a solution were in sight on both sides, which essentially involved keeping existing territory, or the territory that is possessed on both sides, retaining that and building a solution there. But there's been essentially no progress since, as far as I can tell. Talk, but no progress. And I would argue that a lot of the reason from that stems from Chinese concern about Tibet, renewed Chinese desire not to essentially solve this in India's favour at the moment. I think the maritime commons is becoming an area of increased competition. We're hearing interesting reports of an alleged incident in the South China Sea, but involving the two countries. But certainly in the Indian Ocean, there are very strong threat perceptions on the Indian side there. China's energy security needs, its legitimate need to use the Indian Ocean as a highway of access to energy resources is not fitting well with India's concern about maintaining a dominant role in its own maritime backyard. I think in regional forums, such as the East Asia Summit, the one that I'm, I guess, most familiar with, we've seen what should or could be a more cooperative relationship, nonetheless degenerating into competition. The very fact that China sought to exclude India from the East Asia Summit at its establishment is a pretty disturbing sign, and a very clear sign, I think, of the way China sees India's role in Asian strategic architecture. That is not much of a legitimate role to play. In South Asia too, Indian commentators always, I guess, worry about China's so-called string of pearls, China's cultivation of relationships with India's maritime neighbours in particular. And one can argue there are reasons for that on China's part, but it's certainly feeding a competitive dynamic between the two nations. And finally, India moving into East Asia, again, as recent incidents in the South China Sea have suggested, India's search for energy in essentially Vietnam's exclusive economic zone, India's engagement with powers in East Asia, including in a security sense, is I think, feeding a competitive dynamic as far as China's concerned. We're not seeing public expressions of Chinese concern about this to a great extent at the moment, but I do think that that's got every potential of changing. At the military level, of course, the Indian military is quite explicit in identifying China as a major reason for its modernisation in recent years, not only at sea, but also air and land, the raising of mountain divisions, for example, for the border. China is much more calm in the way it identifies India as a driver or not a driver of its military modernisation, but public statements are not everything. The fact that, for example, that there are credible accounts of Chinese medium-range ballistic missiles, solid-fueled missiles being targeted at India, the fact that China is increasing its capacity to project power into the Indian Ocean. The fact that we'll get to in a moment that the China-Pakistan military relationship is certainly not diminishing all suggests to my mind that there is some degree of Chinese concern about balancing India militarily. Having said that, there's no question in my view that China's primary focus is on East Asia and that most of its angst, if you like, remains focused on its eastern periphery. Economically, as we've said, it's a pretty beneficial relationship in many ways. However, and when we've seen the figures grow massively, but there are potentially competitive dynamics emerging. For a start, India is becoming increasingly concerned about its trade deficit with China. As India moves to become a manufacturing power, I think we'll see more direct competition. I mean, this Hyundai factory in India, for example, that's pictured, I think, is a sign of things to come. I think there will be a greater sense of competition as manufacturing powers. And the levels of investment in both countries, and indeed the quality and types of investment, are really proven to be quite unsatisfactory, especially, again, to India. And, of course, India has moved really faster and more firmly than most countries in applying security restrictions to Chinese investment in India as well. And as I've said before, on the energy front at the moment, even while there is limited cooperation, it's primarily a case of China generally outbidding India in third countries. Soft power. Look, both India and China have actually had some pretty spectacular failures, I would argue, on this front in recent years, and I don't think that we're seeing a direct contest between these two powers certainly not in any Cold War sense, or even in the sense that I think, let's say, the US and China could be argued to have a soft power competition. India's not a great exporter of democracy. It's very proud of its democracy, but I don't think it sees it as particularly an export model at this stage. And certainly, we haven't seen a targeted effort by India to compete with Chinese soft power in Asia or elsewhere. The fact, for example, that India, I think, has performed woefully in state-sponsored broadcasting as a tool of international influence is I think, a sign that not only is India not competing with China in this area, it's not really competing with anyone at this stage. Most of its best soft power continues to be what comes out of the private sector, really a creative public sphere. Having said that, I think this is going to change in the years ahead, and we're seeing some hints, especially in the field of foreign aid, the fact that India's aid program, for instance, to Afghanistan, is not only quite large, quite effective, but I think projecting a pretty capable image of India, better than the image that the Indian government projects in many, many other ways. I think we will see in Africa in particular, but also potentially in other parts of the world, a little bit more direct competition between these two powers to come. But as I said, if we're looking at the Olympic Games in Beijing and the Commonwealth Games in New Delhi as signs of a soft power competition, it's not much of a competition at the moment. A bit of failure on both parts, I would argue. And finally, just on a slightly lighter note, if there's any question about soft power partnership between India and China, I'm not familiar with many movies that are India-China co-productions. This is one, and I don't recommend it. So, moving to a conclusion, really, what lies ahead? I'd say there are about four key challenges I'd like to focus on in the India-China relationship that add, I guess, although they certainly have benefits for at least one side, but they also pose obvious complications, and I think on balance will tend to increase the competition in the relationship, pushing it a bit closer towards rivalry. One of those is the US-India relationship. I won't sort of go into chapter and verse about that. Many of you know more about that than I do. Certainly, I'm sure you do, Ashley. But look, the concern in Beijing about Indian power, about India's rise, I think has increased pretty significantly in the past 6 or 7 years, and I think a lot of that relates to the India-US relationship. In fact, if you think that until about 2005, the Chinese appeared to be almost trying to compete with the US for influence in India. I think following 9/11, the Chinese belatedly began to engage India in a pretty positive way. From about 2005 onwards, I think when the Chinese began to realise that the US and India were really getting quite serious in this relationship, and that they'd really already gone quite a long way, and the nuclear deal, obviously a big marker, a big measure of that, I think that was a turning point in Chinese perceptions of India's rise. I don't think there are any illusions in China anymore that Beijing is going to be able to somehow wean India off the relationship with the United States. And I think that's actually one of the reasons why we've seen a harder line against India on many issues, including the border, since then. Having said that, I don't think there's any sense that India is going to become a firm ally of the United States or a formal ally of the United States. I think India rather will be pretty watchful of the US-China relationship, and you know, for better or worse, the Indian diplomatic establishment will tend to defer making hard choices on this. I think it's one of the big challenges for India, not only vis-à-vis China, but more generally. But having said all of that, I think there's a clear sense in India, despite the ups and downs in recent years, you know, the disappointment of the fighter aircraft deal this year, for example, I think there is a very clear sense in the Indian security establishment now that it's not a choice between the US or China as a strategic partner. The US is the only of those powers that offers real strategic partnership to India. The question is, will they take it, not will they seek anything vaguely equivalent with China. Threat perceptions of China are just too strong. And I think, as I said, one of the real drivers of threat perceptions about China and India is the relationship with Pakistan. If you ask me to name one fundamental cause of mistrust in the India-China relationship, I think this is it. as you know, plenty of Indian security thinkers and practitioners will remind you, if it wasn't for the military and in particular the nuclear and missile assistance that has flowed to Pakistan over the years from China one way or the other, India's strategic environment would be quite different. The only measures, I think, or the only steps I think that Beijing can really take to address Indian security concerns about this relationship at a very deep level would involve Beijing essentially demonstrably placing relations with India ahead of relations with Pakistan. Now, I don't see any sign of this at present. Perhaps there was a hint of this in 1999 during the Kargil conflict, perhaps again in the Twin Peaks conflict of 2001-2000, or confrontation, I should say, of 2001-2002, where China did not take the complicating steps it could have. It didn't try to complicate Indian military planning by, you know, keeping open its options on the border with India. It made it clear that it wasn't going to cause mischief at that time. Having said that, that was then, that was before 2005. I think all bets are off in future India-Pakistan confrontations, and that's going to cause great concern to the Indian security establishment. The nuclear dimension interests me very much because I think the India-China nuclear relationship is possibly the least studied dyad, if you like, of major power nuclear relations. It's the one great power nuclear relationship that could lead to confrontational conflict, and yet there's a strange sense of denial, especially in Beijing, about this relationship. You know, China is, for example, unwilling to recognise India as having any legitimacy attached to its nuclear program and therefore talks about strategic stability. The idea of a no-first-use agreement, which, you know, between these two powers is actually not ludicrous because they both have declared no-first-use policies. All of this is off the table as far as Beijing is concerned. I think in the long run, these are unsustainable positions. I think in the long run, India and China do need to talk about nuclear issues pretty frankly. And I think there's more willingness to do this on India's part than China's at the moment. So I would certainly put a big question mark over the nuclear dimension. The good news is that this is not a rivalry at present, I would argue. There is no arms race between China and India. I think the Indian progress towards a submarine-based second strike capability is pretty uneven. Some might call it leisurely. It's advanced in recent years, but I still think it's quite a long way from fruition. And I think China's primary nuclear threat perceptions are obviously still about the United States, not India. The Maritime Commons, as I've said, is going to become increasingly central, I think, to a competitive dynamic in the relationship. And it's not only China's reliance on the Indian Ocean for energy imports, although I do think that is fundamental. I think the idea that China can somehow replace Indian Ocean energy imports with pipelines is, you know, some scholars have observed, still something of a pipe dream, both because of quantity and cost issues. At the same time, I think China now sees India in the Indian Ocean as, if not a hostile power, then certainly a power that would align with the United States in a wider confrontation. So we will see, I think, more Chinese presence in the Indian Ocean. We will see a more competitive dynamic. I don't think the rivalry thesis applies yet. I think folks like Robert Kaplan, who've you know, made noises about that, are a bit early in their judgments. But I certainly think we can't rule it out, and therefore it would make good sense for India and China to begin trying to develop a maritime confidence-building regime sooner rather than later. And this reported incident in the South China Sea that remains very mysterious at the moment, where apparently a Chinese vessel challenged an Indian ship, warship visiting Vietnam, is perhaps a sign of things to come. Now, a quick word about Australia before I conclude, and that's because I think Australia's in a pretty piquant position, not only between the US and China, but between India and China. And I've actually criticised some of the arguments in Australia about the US-China relationship, what that means for us, because I think it excludes, it downplays the role of third powers in Asia, especially India. Now, it's not so well known here, but India is rising rapidly as an Australian trade partner. We're still much more dependent on trade with China, but India is now our fourth largest export market and an enormous has enormous growth potential, for example, in coal, perhaps one day in uranium if the current Australian government changes its policy. It's a very awkward position in some ways, but it's a very beneficial position too, because I think Australia is not, contrary to what some scholars in Australia would argue, Australia is not going to be confronted with a really tough choice between China and the United States in the years to come. I think Australia's already made its choice in that regard, and the choice is the United States. Australia is, however, going to, this doesn't mean Australia's not going to be wanting to influence US policy in its relations with China. Australia certainly doesn't want confrontations that are unnecessary, but I think Australia's interests align pretty closely with those of the US in Asia. And therefore, I think, at this stage at least, Australia's got a pretty strong convergence of interests with India also. I think Australia is, in its fairly complex hedging strategy about Chinese power, engagement economically, absolutely, engagement at a social level as well, but hedging at a strategic level, India plays a small but genuine part. India is one of the other Asian democracies that Australia is trying to build its security relations with, and particularly in the Indian Ocean, where our interests are large and increasing, I think an Australia-India maritime relationship is going to be a pretty important part of the picture in years to come. That said, Australia hasn't had to make big choices between China and India, and so the question remains, if a genuine rivalry does evolve between these two powers in the years ahead, what will it mean for a country like Australia that's deeply dependent on Asian stability? I'll end with that question, Ashley, and look forward to your thoughts, questions, comments.
Thank you, Rory. That's great. I'm going to open the floor right away and recognize people as I see them. Jonathan Pollock.
Yes, Jonathan Pollock.
John, just hang on. I think we've got a microphone that you... Because your words are going to be transcribed for posterity. Thank you.
Yes, Jonathan Pollock from Brookings. Good to see you, Rory. A comment and a question. The comment is more about whether the characterization of rivalry is frankly an artifact of overheated media discussion and the like that is self-evident. It does seem to me that a lot of what you describe strikes me as kind of, if you will, a bounded competition, not necessarily an easy relationship, but one that, frankly, we shouldn't be all that worried about. I wonder if we might draw you out on that. My question, though, has more to do with the pivotal issue of Pakistan. There are growing but quiet indications of a recognition of increasing unease in some Chinese circles about Pakistan and the liabilities of this relationship. It is not to revisit every aspect of past history. History is history. Yeah. But it seems to me, from some evidence that we've seen, that there's growing unease in some Chinese circles about Pakistan, its intentions, its capabilities, the growth of Pakistan's nuclear forces, ironically enough, which, if according to some estimates, would suggest within the next decade will be larger than those of China in terms of number of warheads. That's kind of has a certain sobering effect. So my question would be, not so much in terms of India's larger stakes in a relationship with the United States, which I see as a given, but more whether and how there could ever be some kind of a meaningful discussion between India and China on this absolutely central relationship. Not to say that bygones will be bygones, but both have extraordinary stakes that are at risk here for a whole host of reasons that that warrant our discussion. If I could just add to this, there is a tendency in some circles, that, including American circles, if you look at the question of Afghanistan's future and the like, to, you know, would people buy a relationship with a slightly used country, if you will, something that frees up the United States from kind of open-end involvement here? India has substantial equities here for all kinds of obvious reasons, and China to some extent does as well. So I'm just wondering whether, looking at Asia in the longer term, whether the picture is necessarily as worrying, or whether in this context you could actually see some, dare I say, progress between the two big powers.
Sorry, the slightly used country is Pakistan or Afghanistan?
More Afghanistan, Pakistan. Well, take your pick. Right.
Just asking. That's right. Look, I think firstly, and I think your first your comment deserves a response as well. And that's partly what got me started on this research. I probably should have explained that at the beginning. I mean, I think we're doing some work at the Lowy Institute on the India-China relationship, partly because it matters a lot to Australia, partly because we think it's understudied, and partly because there is a bit of this heat in the media about rivalry. We do need to interrogate it, but that doesn't mean we need to dismiss it. I think that yes, at the moment, in the end, we could be arguing about semantics here, and the term that I would use, you say bounded competition, fine, competitive coexistence is what I'm playing with at the moment. It's not beyond that at the moment, but I think there are all sorts of...
Sorry, I better start again. Just very quickly, we're looking at rivalry because it's been a hot topic in the media. It might be an artifact, artificial sort of expression, but I think there's something deeper there. I would call it competitive coexistence at the moment, or I think bounded competition is nice. There is much more potential for this relationship to change, in my view, than a lot of other great power relationships. And it's because the interests of these countries are growing, not in unpredictable ways, but in relatively unbounded ways at this stage. And they're getting wider. I mean, the fact that India is playing in the Pacific a lot more than it was, diplomatically, militarily, and so on, is something I don't think many of us would have anticipated 10 or 15 years ago. So it won't just be in China in the Indian Ocean. I think the fact that you've got these two populations with enormous expectations and with a history, and I didn't really have time to touch on this, but with a history of not being interested in one another, not understanding each other, the level of expertise in both countries about the other is pretty abysmal. You can invite. We're organising something in Sydney shortly where we're trying to invite top Indian and Chinese scholars about the other countries, and we're having trouble getting beyond a few obvious names. These are all worrying signs, I think. So I think it's worth exploring it into the future. Rather, really, we're looking, I guess, at the next 20 odd years, in my view. On your specific point about Pakistan, I think that objectively it would be great to see US-China collaboration in trying to manage Pakistan's problems or help Pakistan manage its problems. And I think we saw, well, three-way even better, but I think US-China, we were hoping for some potential on this about a decade ago, and I don't think it's really delivered. I think China's wake-up call, some of China's wake-up calls should have come in the last few years, including the incidents leading up to the Red Mosque attack in 2007. The fact that Chinese workers of all kinds are at risk in Pakistan, I don't think there's a hell of a lot of I'm sure there's gratitude, but I don't think there's a hell of a lot of control of the way certain groups in Pakistan operate against Chinese interests. What's extraordinary for me is that any sort of concern in China either hasn't come sooner or that we're not seeing more overt signs of it. And I really hope you're right. If you're hearing signals of disquiet within China about Pakistan, it's about time. I would hope to see progress on that front. Engaging India in that is going to be even harder, and that's where I don't hold out any particular hope. I mean, my sense of Indian thinking on Pakistan is that the best that can be hoped for is the kind of sort of quarantining of Pakistan's problems from India, and of course the appetite in Pakistan for an Indian hand in solving its problems would be pretty much zero. So I guess I would still boil it down to the US and China and hope that Afghanistan is something they can talk a bit more about. Of course, I think it was the National Intelligence Council's 2025 report that had a wonderful scenario of the Shanghai Cooperation Organisation intervening in Afghanistan in the years to come. I still think that's a scenario. That's charitable.
Sorry. Bronson.
Rory, shift your gaze. Yeah. Sorry, I'm Bronson Percival from East-West. Shift your gaze eastward. India is reached out into the Pacific. There's a great deal of talk about growth in the Japanese-Indian relationship. There are Taiwanese ministers going to India. There's just the incident with Vietnam and Indian and Chinese navies, although exactly what happened isn't clear.
Yeah.
But there's a certain hollowness in this Indian reach-out. It just seems to, there doesn't seem to be much substance. Mm. And I'd like to have you talk about where this re-energized look east actually fits in Indian priorities. I don't think it's very high.
Yeah, look, I think it hasn't been high, but there's movement. And the big question is this an all of government? I mean, actually, is anything in India an all of government policy decision? Probably not. I think, you know, strategic policy is not something India's had a history of doing well. And in fact, just as an aside, if there is some deliberate goading of China happening at the moment by India, I think they've actually picked the wrong issue at the wrong time to do it. I mean, I can understand why there might be views in India that you know Pakistan can be India's Vietnam can be India's Pakistan, you know, that somehow I guess provocations or intervention or interference by China in other parts of India's periphery can somehow be balanced with Indian behaviour in the South China Sea. But I don't think this is the issue at this time, unless India really has a great plan and some great partnerships to bring in support of that plan, and I suspect that's not the case. I think the Indian Navy, which I think has done a lot of good things in terms of its proactive diplomacy, however, does risk being out in front on issues like this, or perhaps at this time risks being behind. I mean, if we've got a foreign minister who's encouraging Indian exploration in the South China Sea, but hasn't got a wider strategy in place for when or if that goes wrong, I think we've got a concern. Because I also think that while we've all got an interest in freedom of navigation in the South China Sea, peaceful resolution of the disputes and so forth, and multilateral resolution of the disputes preferably, I don't think India should be the test case for us. I think it needs to be a Southeast Asian country that is the test case that the rest of us support. I do think, again, though, that we've got to look at the future because so many things about India's diplomacy have changed in the last decade or two, that Indian interests will get increasingly engaged in East Asia. A lot of its key trading relationships are heading in that direction. It wants to play at the big table of the East Asia Summit. I wouldn't rule it out, but I still think at the moment there's a big question mark over the look east diplomacy, and I think West Asia ultimately ranks higher at this stage in India's strategic hierarchy. I think the neighbourhood 1, West Asia 2, East Asia 3 of priority regions of concern.
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah.
Hi, Kelly Curry from the Project 2049 Institute. I wanted to ask you about Nepal and Burma, two countries that I haven't heard you talk about, but where China-Indian competition is certainly taking place.
Sure. Fairly short answers there, partly because I don't claim expertise on either of those countries, but I think they certainly feature in this this diplomatic contest. I think there is a diplomatic contest. I think the Indians are playing it more consciously than they used to. However, I think they're playing at a huge disadvantage in Burma, and they always will be, while the regime is of its current complexion politically. I think if India thinks it can compete on equal terms with China in Burma, in the current Burma, I think it's mistaken. And I think it might even be advisable for India to think about at least hedging its bets and playing a bit more with the democratic opposition as it once did. In Nepal, again, I hear sort of reports of much increased Chinese diplomatic influence, but nonetheless, I think Nepal at this stage still looks more, reluctantly, still looks more to New Delhi than it does to Beijing. So I think India is not going to lose that one, but it's always going to be difficult. So, yeah.
Yes, it's right here.
Ryan Jacobs from the U.S. Asia Institute. Quick comment on Mr. Pollack's original question. Is there also, or from your research, do you think there's also the feeling within the Chinese policymaking community that by having an unstable Pakistan, you have India off balance? Because then, as you were saying, it has to deal with that two-front war potentially. So is that the reason, perhaps, that there isn't that Sino-U.S. cooperation on Pakistan? Because China sees that as a possibility.
Yeah.
And then a question, and maybe you could expand a bit on it. What about water security arrangements between India and China?
So you said water?
Water security arrangements, because that always seems to be a big deal with India and the flow rates coming from China.
Yeah.
And that was it. Thank you very much, though.
Thanks. Look, I think the received wisdom in the Indian strategic community is that the China-Pakistan relationship is all about keeping India off balance, you know, caged, contained within Southeast Asia. And, of course, it's very, very hard to get any kind of open expression of the Chinese view on this. And I know that, you know, some people have done some very good research on the Chinese scholarly literature on China-India relations, and this sort of thing barely rates a mention. But that shows an enormous gap between what China's doing and what even independent Chinese experts are saying. So we have to think, well, what is it all about? And at the moment, I don't think we have, you know, many great substitutes for the Indian theory, or at least the Indian theory is part of the answer, even though, you know, Chinese access to the Indian Ocean wider issues, wider strategic concerns matter as well. And if you take it far enough back, there are not many countries that are China's sort of loosely termed allies, so, you know, each one of them counts. But I do think that the keeping India busy is part of the answer. On water, I think you had Brahma Chalani here last week, didn't you? I think, yeah, I mean, look, some people are really studying this issue now, and I think, again, it's, although I didn't mention it in my presentation, it's certainly probably a fifth or a sixth of these complicating factors, or at least it's one of those points I mentioned earlier where what should be a common interest, a common need of two massive populations in developing countries, has potential to become a source of tension. My understanding is that there's growing concern in India really about Chinese use of the headwaters of the sources of India's big rivers and a reluctance to share precise information about what China's doing. So I think this certainly has a lot of potential to be a source of competition in the years ahead. I haven't studied it in detail, and I know that I should.
On the water issue, I would recommend you look at Brahma's book.
Yeah, I think Brahma's just written about this, which is why I'm reluctant to leap in. Yeah, sorry.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
I'm Abhimani Chandra from CSIS. You should stand up. I have a question regarding China's presence in Kashmir, following from the previous question. Recently, there were conflicting reports about sort of the skirmish in Ladakh. There's also talk about China's military presence in Azad Kashmir.
Yeah.
How do you see this moving forward? This is obviously a very sensitive issue for India, but India has its own issue with Kashmiri people, and it's not been very aggressive about this.
Hmm. Look, I haven't talked about Kashmir at all, so thanks for introducing it. And I think, just going back a little bit, you know, as many of you know, one of the sources of friction in recent years has been a view in India that China is actually almost, you know, reneging on understandings on various border issues, not only getting loud about its claim on Arunachal Pradesh again, but also through its use of stapled visas and so forth, really sending signals about, you know, clearly not recognising Indian sovereignty in Jammu and Kashmir. However, I'm pretty wary about reports of the scale of China's military presence in POK or in Gilgit. You know, these reports came out last year in the press. Indian politicians have repeated them and so forth. But my impression is that, you know, that these are unconfirmed reports, and moreover, there's a question mark about if there are Chinese forces there, what their role might be. And I guess the most logical explanation is infrastructure development, for all sorts of strategic purposes for China, but not necessarily military purposes. The question of skirmishes on the border is another real area of concern, partly because information is so sketchy, and media on both sides, but here I'll especially talk about the Indian media,
does have a tendency to magnify these. And this is a condition that I think hasn't held in previous major power relations, especially on this scale. The fact that the Indian media is really one of the most dynamic, competitive, commercial mass medias in history means that the premium on truth isn't always great. And at the same time, you're getting some pretty wild voices in the Indian media, in the Chinese media, generally state-sanctioned wild voices, but sometimes voices that probably the powers that be in China would prefer to manage a bit better, or voices that they unleash at certain times and then have trouble reining back. In other words, as incidents occur in this relationship, I think you're going to have a lot more noise and a lot more misinformation in the public space than you've had really in any previous great power relationship that I can think of. And that itself is going to make it very hard for politicians, both democratic and in China, to manage the situation when things get out of hand. So for me, it's not even specific incidents that are so much the cause for concern, because we can always ask who was at blame in a completely unmarked frontier. But I think there's genuine potential for these to magnify.
I'd just like to make one point and emphasize what Rory just said. One has to be careful when one uses the term skirmishes, because these are not exchanges of fire. These are not military exchanges of the kind that one imagines when one uses the word skirmish. Most of the reported incidents are essentially acts of destruction of border markers, or at least markers that one side has put up to stake its own claims. Now, the point, as Rory pointed out, is that the border is physically undemarcated. And so nobody quite knows where exactly the lines are. And so both sides end up putting up structures in order to stake certain claims, which on occasion end up being destroyed by the other because they simply don't believe those structures are in their own territory as they understand them. And that has happened, I think, not infrequently. But that is quite different from what the term skirmish would suggest, where there's actually an exchange of fire between troops and things like that. At least as far as I know, happened recently.
There was one alleged incident, and I'm not familiar with a recent skirmish, but there was one alleged incident, I think, 2 years ago, where the initial Indian media allegation was that there was shooting involved. And it apparently took the Indian government 2 weeks to find out which journalist was the source of this false rumour and point out to this journalist and his employer that it wasn't necessarily in the national interest and could you please stop, by which time it had done the rounds of the echo chamber of the Indian media. So, I mean, Ashley's right. It's mostly a very relatively civilised form of military interaction on a contested frontier, people leaving cigarette packets in each other's sort of claimed territory as a sign that they've been there. But it can get worse. Yeah.
Yes, sir.
Alex Kaiserling, the World Bank. I'd like you to address the lack of modern infrastructure in India on its ability to compete with China, which is investing huge amounts in that area.
Mm-hmm. Compete economically, militarily?
Ability to compete.
Yeah. Yeah. Look, I think, it's obviously one of the most pressing needs for India's development. I think just looking at India, purely India for the moment, I would argue the next sort of 15 to 20 years are going to be absolutely critical in whether India is the success that many of us want it to be or not. And it's a race against time to develop the infrastructure, the education, the employment, all of these things to really satisfy the Indian population as well as accelerate development. But of course, India's economy is growing extraordinarily fast despite having very much modern infrastructure. So I guess some of us like to imagine what it would be like if those brakes were taken off. But I'll quickly add a military dimension as well, because one of the arguments that's made in India is that a lack of modern infrastructure is also very difficult or very dangerous in terms of any future military competition with China. India can't get forces to the front at anything like the rate China possibly can. This could, of course, be very good for the people of places like Arunachal Pradesh if they finally get decent roads as a result of military competition, as long as the war doesn't happen. Exactly.
That's right.
Hi, I'm from Hindustan Times and Indian newspaper. What are your thoughts on
India and China cooperating, coordinating actions, especially as parts of BRICS and other such attempts. Yeah. They coordinated and cooperated on climate change talks in Copenhagen.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thanks.
Okay. Look, I mean, very quickly, I mentioned this early on. I mean, I see this as very much functional, issue-specific cooperation, and unfortunately, for those powers, it's very limited. It tends to be very limited in time and in issue. The fact that after Copenhagen, which of course caused great frustration to many of us, including the gentleman in the middle of that picture, who incidentally seems to be being studiously ignored by the other two gentlemen in the picture, you know. Straight after that moment, which for many, I think, Western diplomats was a real nightmare, nonetheless, my impression is that within months, the two countries were no longer sharing, especially China was not sharing with India, clear information about what its next steps were going to be on climate change policy or climate change diplomatic strategy. So I think it's pretty limited, and I think until China unambiguously supports India's candidacy for a permanent seat or India's hope, aspiration for a permanent seat on the UN Security Council, we're not going to see the kind of genuine goodwill that would lead to sustained multilateral cooperation between India and China.
There's a very good article which actually is in the book that's going to be released on Wednesday by Harsh Pant. And the basic point that he makes is that on broad issues of global order, China and India have substantial convergence, because they essentially have a series of grievances against a Western-dominated political system. But when it comes to the bilateral, the relationship quickly becomes scratchy. And so the question that Harsh leaves the chapter with is the overarching cooperation on global issues sufficient to override the kind of scratchiness that exists in the bilateral relationship, or will the reverse trump the former? So this is worth looking at. Yes, sir.
Hi, Daniel Aiken from the Korea Economic Institute. Was wondering, back to the gentleman's question of India looking east, even further east, I was wondering if you could comment on India's developing relationships with Japan and South Korea, yep. And especially since those two countries are prominent U.S. allies, whether the U.S. might try to foster India's relationships with those countries.
Sure. Well, again, these relationships were a long time in coming, and for a long time, I mean, Buddhism, for example, wasn't sufficient glue to bring these nations together. But there's been dramatic movement, I'd say, in the past decade in both relationships. I'm sure it's in U.S. interests for this to happen. I think it's in Australian interests also. But I think this has been happening really almost of its own accord, and the fact that I think Japan has been engaging India dramatically, not only as a security partner but economically in aid. You know, the best public transport that I've been on in a long time is the Delhi Metro. Essentially a Japanese aid project with a few things added on. Much better than any public transport in Sydney, I should add. Maybe we need a bit of Japanese aid. But look, that's happened, I think, because of strategic judgments made in Japan. We often criticise the Japanese for not being strategic enough in their thinking. I think this is a case where Tokyo has been. I think the fact that there's now a trilateral conversation among the foreign ministries of India, Japan and the US is another sign of this. And we're beginning to see, and of course a Japan-India security declaration, and I think we're beginning to see movement in the India-South Korea relationship in a similar direction. I should add that economically, I would actually look towards the India-ROK relationship more than the India-Japan relationship, partly because I think the way South Korea does business fits better with Indian conditions, including the fact that it's not always an easy business environment in India. You've got to get your hands dirty, but nonetheless, the rewards are great. And I think India and ROK are hitting it off pretty well there. You know, that was a Hyundai factory you saw earlier in the slideshow in India, so that's a sign of things to come, I think.
Raghuveer.
Thank you very much, Raghuveer Goyal, India Globe in Asia Today. My question is that how seriously you think India should take threat from the Chinese military buildup and also in the South China Sea international waters, and also if I can talk about this triangle, India, China and the United States. Thank you.
Sure. Do you want to take any more before I wrap up, or?
I'll go as long as you want.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question, but it relates a lot to what I've said, so I'll just emphasise a couple of points. Firstly, there is, and maybe I didn't fully answer the questions I set for myself at the beginning, you know, my assessment at the moment is we don't have a broad state of rivalry between China and India. I think where it's most pronounced is the Indian security establishment's perception of China. You know, a lot of the Indian security establishment sees a rivalry developing, and this is not, at this stage, reciprocated by the Chinese. In fact, sometimes I think some of the Chinese thinkers actually underestimate how much this annoys the Indians. In some ways, India would prefer to be seen as a threat by China because it would be seen as a sign of respect. And at the moment, I think India doesn't perceive that respect as there. But I think there are genuine threat perceptions in the Indian security establishment. I don't think we can dismiss those. I mean, the word paranoia is sometimes used. I don't actually accept that. If you had a dangerous neighbourhood, as India does, if you had a history of war with a neighbour who is nuclear-armed and, frankly, you know, considerably more powerful than you across most dimensions of military power, I think you would be concerned too. The India-China-US triangle, you know, what more to say? I think India-US, not a formal alignment, or not a formal alliance, but a strategic partnership. I think the best India can hope for with China is coexistence and maybe some collaboration occasionally on transnational issues, but I have trouble seeing it develop beyond that until, in particular, the China-Pakistan relationship changes.
Yes.
Behnam from the Elliott School. Just a question about some of the energy issues that you spoke about much earlier in your presentation, and the rise of both Blue Water Navies. 80% Chinese oil gets through the South China Sea, 90% for India. China is looking to hedge more for overland gas pipelines in the next 10 to 15 years. What is India doing? Is it hoping to stock up more on the Blue Water Navy side, or any foreign refineries, any other things to protect their energy reserves?
Yeah, look, my impression about India's quest for energy security is it wants everything it can possibly get from every source imaginable. For example, Australia is part of the answer for India, not oil, but certainly natural gas, coal, uranium, and Australia's pretty conveniently located for India in that regard. But I think it will primarily be India, Middle East, and Africa, and in that sense, look, the Indian Blue Water Navy matters, but it's a shorter distance to protect. It's actually a much more protectable, if I can use that word, energy lifeline than China has. I mean, China's situation is obviously more challenging for India's. But look, also, I think there will be occasions where the two countries do cooperate. I just don't think it's going to be across the board in the energy space.
Yes.
Yes, Monty McGee, Senate Foreign Relations
Committee.
Yeah.
Okay. Monty McGee, Senate Foreign Relations Committee.
Yeah.
My question, you talked about paranoia within the Indian defense infrastructure. Have you had any indication about preparations for cyber warfare or cybersecurity from the Indian side? Is that part of the portfolio in which they're putting forward?
Yeah, okay, I used the word paranoia. I didn't say it was my word, but it is a word that's often used. I think, again, I didn't mention cyber, but this is, again, one of the areas where I think India has pretty serious threat perceptions, and somewhat with good reason. I mean, we've had pretty credible reports in the public domain of cyber attacks on locations in India, ultimately originating from locations in China. So it's not outlandish. And unfortunately... For India, despite India's extraordinary development in IT, India's extraordinary services sector, this is not very well harnessed by the state. I think someone said to me recently at another forum, shouldn't Western countries be concerned about how the Indians might use all of the information they've gathered in their through their services sector? You know, they've got all our credit card numbers and so forth. You know, I would have great difficulty imagining the Indian state essentially saying to various companies in India, give us all your information, we're going to use this for comprehensive, you know, national means. That's not how India works. But India does perceive that's how China might work, and at this stage I'd say India's very much the weaker party in cyber.
Yes.
Hugh Grindstaff. I know this is going to seem like it's out in left field.
Yeah.
But a six-letter word called Russia.
Yeah.
And
it is out of left field.
a five-letter word called Putin coming back into power.
Yeah.
It's like he's been on the sidelines for the last 4 years, sort of going places, doing things,
yeah,
and sort of putting things together. How do you see a future role for Russia, China, India?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, for a start, I don't see great cooperation among the three. You know, their foreign ministers meet. I mean, a lot of foreign ministers meet. Doesn't mean that there's strategic coordination. Secondly, I haven't mentioned the Russia-India relationship yet, but it is an important relationship. It's one of the few old relationships that India has carried forward into its new incarnation as an emerging power. And there's a lot for India in that relationship, not only nuclear assistance, but arms sales. I mean, the quality of what Russia sells to India is better than what Russia has been selling to China. And of course, that's becoming past tense now anyway. But beyond that, I don't particularly see, you know, some sort of three-way balancing game among the powers. You know, India will have a better relationship with Russia than China does, I think, permanently. And that isn't necessarily going to translate to Russia doing anything dramatic on India's side in an India-China confrontation. I could be wrong there, but I think this is not a core issue for Russia.
John, Rory, if I could ask you to return to a question which is prompted by your conversation here, that the presumption, the frustration of Indian strategic elites that India is not taken more seriously by China. Would either you or Ashley care to elaborate on what are the presumed advantages for India long-term of being an avowed strategic adversary of China? Mm. What exactly would be the presumed, dare I say, benefits of this, as distinct from what demonstrably would be some rather ample liabilities? What, in other words, I understand India's desire for strategic validation. Is this the way to go about it?
Yeah. Both got some thoughts on that, I guess. I
have a different take on this. Yeah. I mean, I don't think the Indian strategic community is looking for a validation of India as a threat. I think they often react to the claim that the Chinese disdain of India equates to China's strategic neglect of India. I mean, those are two different propositions. I've always held the view, and I think Rory said something interesting in his discussion, where he said, whatever China has done towards India has been very subtle. It's not overwrought.
Hmm.
And it's never gone out of its way to make it the sword point of its Asia policy, for all good reasons. And I think very often in the West, people infer from that proposition strategic neglect. And I think Indian elites react to that and say it is not strategic neglect. Of course, we understand that India is not a priority. And in many ways, India is better off, as you point out, not being that priority. And I think the Indian government certainly wants that position to persist indefinitely, because the last thing they need is, in addition to a, you know, cantankerous Pakistan in the West, a more you know, dangerous and more capable power in the North. But the question that Indian elites have to figure out is, how do you create enough consciousness within the governmental machinery to recognize that what China has done in many areas does objectively pose problems for Indian security, without crossing the line into making China essentially the poster child for everything wrong in the security environment? I think that is the kind of tightrope walk that they are involved in.
Hmm. Yeah, three quick thoughts. You're absolutely right. It's not necessarily always going to be in India's interest to be recognised in that way. In fact, it could be quite the opposite. But there are three ways, I think, where it matters. Firstly, you know, we can't discount the fact of pride. I think there is a genuine issue of national pride here. And let's face it, pride plays a pretty big role in Chinese policy as well. Maybe not towards India, but certainly towards, you know, the US and, and a few others. But secondly, on a more strategic level, I think greater recognition of India's potential or power would make India more of a go-to partner or interlocutor for the Chinese on a range of security issues. You know, if China wants to become a serious player in the Indian Ocean, it should talk to the Indians, and it should do it on terms that the Indians are comfortable with. I don't think even that view has registered in Beijing, and I think that would be that would actually be in India's interest, and it probably would be in wider interest too. And finally, going back to the example of the nuclear dimension before, look, I don't think at the moment India's very high on China's threat radar, the nuclear level. But again, this could change, and wouldn't it be nice to have some strategic stability in place as that happened? And that's only going to happen, I think, if China actually does show India a bit of respect on that level. So I think there are a few instances where being noticed actually is a good thing.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. I'm Jin Ninh Nguyen with Voice of Vietnamese Americans. Yeah. From the East, especially Southeast Asia, we kind of looking forward, hoping that India would rise up to be a peace mediator in the region.
Yeah.
Maybe that's a better term. So this question also to Dr. Talis as well. Given the differences in the soft power, the differences in the Buddhism, Hinduism, and Confucianism, as also as the democratic society we're looking at from India, and also the way that China has been acting, would you touch on that soft power in the long run? Because it affects the Indochina areas a lot. Also, would you also touch on the power of consumer spending between India and China?
Yeah.
And also touch on the power between the Chinese overseas and the Indians overseas?
That's a good point.
Thank you. For also for Dr. Talis. And would you give out a time frame? How long would you think, would India have some, would they rise up to play the role? And how long would it take? And what Australia would do to support that role?
you've got a lot of good questions built into one, and I won't be able to answer them all, but I'll attempt a few of them that matter to me. As I mentioned briefly in my presentation, you know, I don't think there is a serious soft power competition between India and China at the moment. I don't think they're competing directly. Now, I think China is certainly attempting, and has for many years attempted, a pretty coordinated use of soft power, to keep using that expression, you know, whether it's Confucius Institutes, whether it's all sorts of funding and support of cultural initiatives. However, and certainly I think Chinese state broadcasting and Chinese international state-sponsored broadcasting is a pretty expensive and sophisticated operation. I don't think it's actually been very effective, but it's a big investment. India has not done anything like that, and I think India's soft power has come much more from the private sector, from and certainly from religion and from history and so forth. Bollywood films, again, very much a private sector initiative. I think in and it's not entirely, you know, frivolous, because when I'm told that, you know, in Afghanistan, for example, pretty much the first Indian plane into Afghanistan after the fall of the Taliban was full of Bollywood videos, and I think that probably did more for India's image in Afghanistan in those first few weeks than a bunch of commandos would have. Look, in the long run, in Southeast Asia, I think Southeast Asia is really the natural sphere of cultural competition between India and China, because of the historical linkages that both have had. I think many people in Australia have tended to underestimate India's influence and importance in Southeast Asia, but I think that's beginning to change. But the critical question for me is: will the Indian government get behind this? And at the moment, India doesn't invest in a coordinated way in soft power projection very well at all. The only exceptions are things like a public diplomacy division of its foreign ministry, which is pretty forward-leaning. They use social media quite well and so forth. But this is really small stuff. It's not a lot of money. Looking to the future, as you said, you asked about the diaspora. That's a much more interesting story, and it's got two edges. One edge is that, yes, the diaspora of both India and China could be, I guess, forces for projecting the influence of these countries, but they can also be, frankly, problems for the governments at home. We've had an unusual experience in Australia that you may or may not have been aware of, where a number of the vast numbers of Indian students that have come to Australia in recent years have got into trouble. They've become victims of crime, in some cases, real or actual alleged racist crime. I'm sure some cases real, but many of the cases were exaggerated by the Indian media, and it became a major issue in the bilateral relationship, and not a good or healthy issue in the bilateral relationship. So there are cases like that, or cases where nationals might get in trouble abroad. We've seen all the evacuations this year by of Indians and Chinese from North Africa and elsewhere, major consular challenges for these countries that they've never had to deal with before, and cases where sometimes military assets will be deployed in pretty dangerous circumstances, and who knows where it might end. So it could, I think, the spread of the Indian and Chinese communities around the world and the demand by the media and the population at home to do something to help our brothers and sisters in Libya or Melbourne or wherever they might be, Fiji, an interesting case for the Indians as well, Southeast Asia, could lead to all sorts of complicated diplomatic or forceful interventions in the years to come. And this could occasionally involve, if not confrontation, then at least Indian and Chinese militaries having to operate side by side and de-conflict. Now that will be interesting. The last thing to say about the diaspora is that from our own experience in Australia, the Chinese diaspora has been much more actively mobilised by the Chinese government than the Indian has by the Indian government. In fact, the Indian government has not mobilised the diaspora at all. The only big protests we've had by Indian Australians have been spontaneous protests. 2008, Olympic torch relay in Canberra, 10,000 Chinese protesters was clearly not a fully spontaneous action. These are the things I think that we'll watch in years to come in countries like Australia that are very much migrant societies. Problems for our governments, I can assure you.
I'll take one last question and give it to the gentleman there.
Hi, Mohsen Dingankar from the Korea Economic Institute. I just have a very quick question and a quick comment. So any kind of relationship generally signifies some level of conflict, competition, and cooperation. Between India and China, you see the former two, you see very little cooperation, even in much touted areas of cooperation, like in national negotiations. You specified about Copenhagen, but say water, there is very little cooperation which is happening on the ground. The relationship is very volatile. Things tend to, the Chinese tend to stop cooperating when they feel like it and then come back to the table. Don't you think this lack of cooperation is a critical hurdle in improving relationships, the relationship in the future? And just a quick comment about you assigned causality about the deterioration in the Sino-Indian relationship post-2005 to the U.S. alignment with India. But don't you think that it is part of a general estrangement, a Chinese estrangement with all of its neighbors? As China grew, its clout increased, it suddenly realized that it could pressure its neighbors, but possibly the foreign ministry overestimated the diplomatic red lines of all of its neighbors. What's your...
Yeah, look, both good questions. The first point, look, I think it's in everybody's interest to have a more cooperative China-India relationship than we see at the moment, because I think India and China are coming up from a very long way down. And if anyone is concerned that India-China cooperation might be somehow a negative thing for wider interests, well, we're such a long way from that reality that we can let it improve a hell of a lot more before we need to think about the consequences. So I think... you're right. There is extraordinarily little cooperation for countries of this size with this proximity and the commonality of needs. The question about causality of China's turn against India, and I really believe that in the last 5 years, the last decade, India-China relations have sort of gone like that. Obviously, it's not only the US-India relationship or the US-India nuclear deal, but I do think that was a marker for Beijing that it's going to be impossible for Beijing to have a better relationship with India than the US will have with India. And because of China's wider concerns, including about the US, that I think solidified some negative behaviour towards India, which is carried on in subtle ways. But there are so many instances of this that we have to assume a pattern there, even if there's no public policy statement that China will make life hard for India. And even though trade and diplomatic dialogue are going on, you know, pretty well. Look, fair point that you made about China's wider relations with its neighbours. And I think India, especially in the last, probably the last 2 years, I think India has fitted that pattern. But you've got to remember that it wasn't until about 2008, 2009 that China began to antagonise Southeast Asia, that its charm offensive began to fail there. It was already, I think, you know, causing some grief in India before 2008, 2009, as early as about, I'd say, 2006. So,
well, on that note, I want to thank you, Rory.
Cheery note to end on. Sorry about that.
Maybe the shape of things to come. Yeah. I want to thank Rory for really walking us through very carefully a thought-through presentation that obviously stimulated a lot of discussion. As I pointed out in the last event we had, this is going to be part of a series that we're going to do on Sino-Indian relations. And so I would invite you to check back and come to the next event whenever we program that. It should be on our website. Thank you all of you for coming here. Thank you.